Look at a Mysterious Universe, Season 29, Episode 18. Coming up on this show, we've got Veridical Nocturnal Intrusions, The Hat Man's Pets, and Paul Wallace joins us to discuss ancient memories of ET contact. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
It's always a pleasure to have Paul on the show, but I must say that I find myself coming away from talking to him like my brain is almost completely fried. I need to go and find out more. I need to read his book more. I need to understand more because it's just so enthralling.
This is the latest in the Eden series, and we came in on the second book of the series, The Scars of Eden. That's where I picked it up, and I was just blown away. You're right. He's one of the most interesting researchers out there when it comes to, well, this term paleo contact, which we go into in the interview, but the idea that our ancestors interacted with aliens, interacted with beings from the stars, the star people. And he goes into the biblical history and does this amazing work on essentially uncovering the root meaning of the ancient Hebrew texts.
Yes.
And pairing that with legends and encounters from history all around the world. He's a really incredible researcher. The new book is The Eden Conspiracy, Ancient Memories of ET Contact and the Bible Before God. Don't forget, you can catch Paul at paulanthonywallace.com, and he's got fifthkind.tv as well, where he's putting up videos. He's incredibly popular on YouTube these days. But we had a fantastic chat with him. We hope you enjoy the interview. Welcoming back to the show, one of our favourite authors, Paul Wallace, returning for his third appearance on Mysterious Universe. Welcome back, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
G'day, guys. It's great to be with you again.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. We're just loving this series, the Eden books. I came in on the second book, Escaping from Eden, and was immediately hooked. Of course, he came back to speak about the Scars of Eden as well. Just a fantastic interview the last time we spoke. So when I saw that the new one had dropped, The Eden Conspiracy, Ancient Memories of ET Contact and the Bible Before God, I thought,
we're in.
We've got to get him back. So thanks again for your time and congrats on the new release.
Oh, thank you so much. Charting strongly around the world, I'm pleased to say. It's exciting.
Yeah, so this is really adding to everything you've been researching over the years. And for those who aren't familiar with your previous work, we might have some new listeners. Just give us very briefly, your background in the scholarly side of what you do, and also how you got onto this line of research, just very briefly.
Well, the field I write in is called paleocontact. So that's the theory that our ancestors in the deep past had contact with other civilizations, meaning ET civilizations. And it's my background that sort of surprises people. My background is in church ministry, 33 years in church-based ministry. So I was a church doctor, working in community healing, a theological educator, training pastors in hermeneutics, which is the principles of interpretation and the history of Christian thought. And I was archdeacon for the Anglican Church in Australia, which is one down from a bishop, sort of a fixer kind of role. And it's unusual for someone with that kind of background to step forward and say, hey, everybody, I think the bulk of what's in the Old Testament is really about aliens. It's not sort of a central theme in mainstream Christianity around the world, but I found it through my work as a theological educator, and it was through applying all the tools that I was teaching my pastors to use in investigating ancient texts, applying those tools to interesting moments and anomalies in the texts of the Bible that surfaced another story hidden in plain sight, just a translation away from being blindingly obvious, that reveals that our ancestors had a lot more company than we generally realize. So that was my way in.
Obviously, it's a very controversial thing to be describing and discussing. Did you find that you suffered any detriment coming out with these stories or coming out with this theory?
Have I suffered any detriment? I think if I were applying for senior jobs in the church scene, I might find I have suffered some detriment. But Beyond that, my social life is a little bit quieter. Many of my ministry colleagues are keeping a bit of a greater distance than previously. Not all, I'm delighted to say. Some are making this journey with me. And other than that, I do get a fair number of emails from week to week from people all around the world violently disagreeing with me. But they are only a tiny fraction of my correspondence, I'm pleased to say. So that's sort of the balance of things.
I mean, yeah, if you're looking for jobs in the church, but let's look at your success. The Fifth Kind YouTube channel, 928,000 subscribers now. Congratulations, you are kicking ass over there.
Yes, thank you. And then we've got the Spanish channel as well, El Quinto Tipo, and that's coming up to around 100,000. And then I've got 92,000 on the Paul Wallace channel. So put them together and it's a respectable figure. But it's really exciting to see because it shows me that there is demand, and it's demand all around the world for conversation in these areas that previously have been sort of considered ridiculous or taboo.
How did you do the Spanish channel? Did you hire someone to repurpose your content, or do you speak Spanish?
I spent 10 years learning Spanish. No, I think we found someone on Fiverr.
I was going to say, that's a lot of work.
We managed to find a very good translator, and neither Tony nor I, my collaborator on The Fifth Kind, are fluent Spanish speakers. So it was a little bit of trial and error to find the perfect translator and then listening to all the feedback from our viewers to get a sense of, is this hitting the mark?
Like, how do you know that he's actually saying what you want him to say? Like, how do you know he's not just making up his own thing?
Well, exactly. That's what we thought. But thankfully, the audience of El Quinto Tipo is very engaged and quite well informed. And we get comments from people who are very well read, know the subject like the back of their hand, and are able to tell us if these translations are really hitting the mark for them, and they are.
That's good. That's lucky you've got that community behind you. Well, let's get into this new research, because it's a great opening. I love that in the very first scene we find you covered in vomit in a bus in Brazil somewhere. But you set this great scene where you're heading to a local corn festival somewhere. Share this scene with us, because I think it's a great opening to the book.
Well, you're right. I opened the book with me being vomited on, and this is really my introduction to the reader, because in all the books, I have to bond with the reader in the first chapter. So in the very first of the series, Escaping from Eden, they're behind my specs with me, seeing my glasses fog up as I face questions, and they hear all my internal dialogue. So I try and pull the reader close, and this time they are feeling the warmth of that vomit through my pants with me and feeling terribly embarrassed. And that was very early on in a trip I made to Brazil in Amazonia. We were traveling in Pernambuco, going out to Pesqueira, out to a corn festival. And it was only my second day in the country, and the person who was sort of in charge of me for those months that I was there thought this was something I should do on day two, a corn festival. And I was thinking, why? What's one of those? And why would that be at all important for me to go to? And I went, and it was an amazing experience, because I'd never seen a whole town celebrate something before. Initially, I thought, well, this would be like the harvest festivals we did at school when I was a boy in England. You know, we'll just have some hymns that talk about the harvest and bring in some spare cans of food, and that'll be it. But the whole town was celebrating. There was music everywhere. Everyone was happy. Strangers were talking to strangers. There was dancing. This went on for hours. There was food on tables in every square that you could just go and eat, all derived from corn. And it was drinks, savouries, sweet. I had no idea you could make so much from corn, but you can. And then this goes on till midnight, when everyone processes holding figurines of this female figure into the church for a mass. So I'm trying to practice my Brazilian Portuguese, which was pretty rudimentary at that point. I think I'd more or less just got beyond hello, yes, no, goodbye, thank you.
Yeah, right.
That was my one sentence. So here I am trying to work out what's going on. What is the celebration? What are we commemorating? And the people around me told me, we're commemorating the Queen of Heaven who came and taught our ancestors how to cultivate crops and corn in particular. And then we go into the church and have a mass. And I'm racking my brains thinking, this doesn't make sense. The Queen of Heaven, that's a Catholic name for Mary. But Mary lived 2,000 years ago. She wasn't here 10,000 years ago giving courses in agricultural science. So I couldn't quite join the dots. And it was only years later that I fully understood what my guide told me when he said, this isn't a Catholic ceremony. Nothing that happened outside the church is a Catholic ceremony, and the Pope is trying to put a stop to 90% of what you just saw.
Mm.
Years later, I realized the Queen of Heaven, in that context, wasn't Mary, the mother of Jesus, really was a primordial figure from tens of thousands of years ago, whom their culture, being indigenous Brazilian Indians and people whose descent was in Western Africa, they were celebrating a tradition that goes back much further into history and prehistory. They were celebrating first contact with advanced beings who helped their ancestors become a civilization. And that's a totally different story to the Catholic story.
Yeah, that's right.
But it took me years to work out. That's what I've been told.
We've got some articles on our site from years ago as well, just researching this mysterious origin of corn, especially when you connect it to the stories of Quetzalcoatl and the idea of this agriculture being introduced by the gods. And you make the point in your book, like agriculture really is the foundation of everything that comes from a civilization because, you know, it gives people the resources they need to have time. They need time to pursue the other things that entails a civilization, an advanced civilization. And I love that you take us from Brazil to the Middle East. You take us to, where is it you were? This was to Tel Arad. Yeah, Tel Arad near Jerusalem. What did you discover there that was connected to this Queen of Heaven legend in Brazil?
Well, to my astonishment, I was sitting listening to a lecture by the archaeologist William Deaver, and he's describing this festival at Tel Arad, which is 16 miles to the west of the Dead Sea. And the archaeological finds showed this pattern of festivals in this town that revolved around standing stones and people baking bread cakes and celebrating somebody called the Queen of Heaven. And as he described this festival, here's a town full of music, dance, celebration, people producing food from corn, eating it, drinking it together. They've got these handheld figurines. They have a festival. They have a ceremony in the temple. I'm sitting there just thinking, I've been there. I've seen this. Why is this ringing so many bells? And I was not in Tel Arad in the 7th century BCE to remember this. It was the Brazilian experience that I was remembering. And bit by bit, I realized that every behavior, every ceremony paralleled the use of incense, the use of bread cakes, even the name, the Queen of Heaven. It was the same festival commemorating the same thing. And the fact that they had standing stones there, well, that is the ancient custom for marking a place of first contact with advanced beings. So in Brazil, they said, we're remembering the moment of tutelage. In Tel Arad, they were saying, we remember this place as the place where we met the Queen of Heaven. And where
Incredible.
She and those she represented taught our ancestors. So it's very much the same story and the same suppression, because in Brazil, it was the church forces of Pope John Paul II who was trying to stop all those ceremonies, get rid of the figurines, stop the ceremonies outside the church. In Tel Arad, it was the Jerusalem Guard who went in, seized those figurines, broke the heads off them, broke the horns off the altar so they could no longer make thank offerings to the Queen of Heaven. And that sent me back into the Bible to realize that this narrative of paleo contact and suppression is told openly in the Bible. The shifting of the narrative is told absolutely honestly. And the narrators tell us in the beginning, Judaism was a canon of paleo contact stories, and then it was changed into a religious narrative of worship and obedience. And it's done in plain sight.
Yeah, this term paleo contact, define that for us.
Well, that is the theory that in the deep past, our ancestors had contact. So paleo is in the beginning, and contact with other civilizations, with non-terrestrial civilizations. So paleo contact is just a shorthand word for that idea.
It would surprise a lot of people to learn that the ancient Jewish people certainly weren't monotheistic. And I was a bit surprised when I heard this, that Yahweh wasn't always there as the God, the one and only God. If Yahweh wasn't the holy name for God, and this is where we're getting into, you know, the core of what you're so good at is digging out the root meanings of these terms and how they've possibly been mistranslated. What is the true meaning of Yahweh? Isn't this what it always was? This was our understanding that Yahweh is the name for God. This is how most people would understand it. But why is that not the case?
Well, by the end of the formation of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, the word Yahweh or Jehovah was being used whenever the writer wanted to think of God, the ultimate being, the source of the cosmos. But when you look back at the earlier stories, you see that that same name is being applied to an entity who is a player in history. And this entity is in competition with other similar entities. The general name for those entities is Elohim, the powerful ones. And much of the Hebrew scripture is taken up with stories of the powerful ones, each with their own human colony, bumping up against each other, competing with one another for resources and hegemony, going to war against each other, and thousands of humans being massacred in the process. So Yahweh was one of those in the earlier stories. What Yahweh means is a great question, because scholars have for generations been trying to get to a meaning and have not succeeded in finding a Hebrew meaning for that word. So in the Eden Conspiracy, I argue that it is a loan word, that it has come into the Hebrew lexicon as a sequence of sounds denoting this entity. And what's interesting about the sequence of sounds is that it matches the phonetic structure of names around the planet that denoted similar kinds of entity. So around the world, we've got this amazing canon of stories that we know as dragon stories. So those are stories of a time when our ancestors were governed over by non-human rulers who had no compassion towards the human beings and who simply exploited them. And some of the legends are very specific about what these entities look like. Some are quite literal, that they were reptilian entities that governed us. In Mesoamerica, it's the feathered serpents who governed us. You go into the Bible, and you've got similar descriptions there of the scaly skin of this entity and his flight feathers, and then this name with the sound in it.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I had this as a question for you later. I know we touched on this the last time you were on the show, but I was just so blown away by it, and I know Aaron was as well, that I was hoping we could cover it again. I want you to take us through this idea of how the Yahweh is a sound. It's a loan word. It's like a sound that's been introduced to the lexicon of that culture. But you explain in the book how it would change over time, because, you know, you're talking about these, dragon, draconic-like entities from Mesoamerica and even in Wales and England, but they have a particular k sound to them, like a Quetzalcoatl or Kukulkan. You know, this makes sense. But how do you go from Yahweh to Kukulkan? What's the connection? Yes. What's the transition.
Exactly. I mean, the way we pronounce them today, they sound completely different, don't they? And yes, around the world, the dragon names have got this k or kh sound in them. So you've got the Coca of Portugal and Spain. You've got the Quechedra and the Ikuchu from Japan. Kukulkan, Kukumats, Quetzalcoatl, Colchis from Georgia, Akek from Egypt. And you listen to that and you think, well, that's nothing like Yahweh. And that's because the H's in the way we pronounce Yahweh have become silent. But in Proto-Northwest Semitic, which is the ancestor of Hebrew, those H's were sounded like this. And they've become silent through a process that's called affrication, which is part of a pattern of sound softening. So as language changes, hard plosive sounds become fricative sounds. So a b becomes a v, becomes a w, t becomes ts, becomes s.
Right.
And h becomes h.
Oh, I see.
So we look at those two H's, and that's the clue linguistically that these stories belong to the world's canon of dragon narratives. They're all marked by this h sound. And it's either a foreign word that's come from another culture and now it's just become a Hebrew word, or it's the evocation of the sound these beings made. And I couldn't help thinking about Doctor Who when I joined those dots, because I can remember so many monsters in Doctor Who, you knew they were lurking in that dark corridor because you could hear them breathing.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if there's that onomatopoeic reason behind the similarity of these names. And it's not just the names that overlap, the shape of the story overlaps. So in the Bible, you've got this moment where the people get rid of Yahweh in exactly the same way they get rid of the dragon in all the other dragon narratives of the world's canon.
Mm. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up as well, because, you know, you gave all those examples, like Quetzalcoatl, for example. These are the feathered serpents. We understand them as draconic already. But what clues do we have in the Bible that Yahweh had this nature as well?
If I say that according to physical descriptions in the Bible, we've got a tough, leathery skin that an arrow can't penetrate, that we've got a being with a long armored tail, that we've got something with flight feathers, that we've got something with a long snout that breathes fire, that does sound rather like a dragon, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
And we tend to read those and think, oh, well, that must be metaphorical. Well, what's that metaphorical of? It's certainly with reference to the destructive power of this being, and maybe it connects with the fact that this being wants a constant supply of beef, lamb, virgin girls, and gold, which is the same thing that dragons all around the world want. I think once you see the parallels, once you realize that the description of the entity is the same and the storyline is the same, where we reach a point where people have been terrorized for so long, they've reached the point of saying, if we defy the dragon, what can it do? It can only kill us. And so they find their collective power. They speak as one voice and say, we're not serving you anymore. And in story after story, that's the end of the dragon's presence. And it almost works that way in the Bible as well. So there are many parallels to be found, and it makes sense of why the people relate to Yahweh in the way they do, why they don't worship him, why they don't want to follow his laws, and why in the end they say, we're firing you, we want a human leader for human society. If Yahweh means God, that's a ridiculous story in 1 Samuel 8. Why would you sack God and replace him with a human being? But it makes perfect sense if he's a draconian being.
And again, we have to put this in the context of that word Elohim being a plural. So we're not talking about one particular entity, we're talking about a group of entities. And I love that you had a nice feature in the book on Mauro Baglino, because I recently picked up his most recent book, Gods of the Bible, a few weeks ago. I haven't read it yet. I opened it. I did open it. And I thought, okay, I've got to talk to Paul before I even tackle this. This was like, digging into the words of the Hebrew words and their origins at a whole other level, really kind of dense stuff. But share with us what Baglino has uncovered over the years. You know, what in his work has informed your own?
Well, Mauro is a friend and a hero of mine, and I had never heard of him. A few years ago when I was writing Escaping from Eden, I didn't know who he was. And it was only towards the end of my book that I learned that this Italian scholar had come to the same conclusions as mine.
Yeah.
With the really serious bona fides as a biblical translator of Hebrew. He was a translator for the Edizione San Paolo in Rome, and he supervised the interlinear translation of Bibles that were approved by the Vatican. So the interlinear rendition has to be very precise, no interpretation. You just give the real root etymological meaning of each word. And his contribution to the Edizioni San Paolo was very significant. 17 books he supervised. They are a leading Bible translator, and they give great kudos to Mauro for the work he did. And I think his most important contribution there was that he argued that many of the words that we've traditionally translated as God shouldn't be translated that way. But rather than get into a huge argument and fight over it, he said, leave those words untranslated, so people can see how the Elohim behave in the text and do the mass for themselves. They can see how El Shaddai operates in the text and work out for themselves what's going on.
What is the El Shaddai? This is one of the words that's been translated as, has it translated as the Lord?
Ah.
But what's its true meaning?
This infuriates me, because this is a moment where many Bible translations have inserted words into the text, and they have created an invented translation for El Shaddai as the Almighty. So traditional Bibles are full of references to the Almighty. And if you read those Bibles, you'll come away thinking there is an entity, the Almighty God, the ultimate being, except it's not there. The Hebrew word is El Shaddai. And Brown Drivers Briggs, which is one of the most respected Hebrew lexicons in the world, says that translation is, what's their phrase? Uncertain.
Right.
And I think the New Jerusalem Bible, it goes a little bit further and says, probably inaccurate. And those are very political answers, because in the rest of the editorial notes, they go on to say, it doesn't mean the Almighty at all. It could mean the powerful one of the plains or the powerful one of the mountains. And that's an interesting point, because the idea of having powerful ones with geographical jurisdictions is mapped out all through the scriptures. These Elohim, each with their own colony, is a story that repeats. And there's a moment when...
It's like they've been given a part of the land to take care
exactly,
of, and the people
that's
included.
Exactly what it, and we've shown the moment where this senior entity, El Elyon, parcels the lands out and gives Yahweh his portion, except Yahweh gets people with no land. So he gets a really raw deal. So he's going to have to go to war to get any land of his own. And that's where Yahweh fits in, a junior member of this sky council.
Yeah, he's almost like a middle manager.
He is. He's a middle manager, junior to others, which is possibly why he's in such a foul mood. But here's the name. I've got to get back to the name, because it's so interesting. The Syrians go to war with the people of Israel, and they lose. And they think, well, it must be because we fought him in the wrong place. He's obviously a powerful one of the mountains. If we draw him into the plains, we can defeat him. He'll be out of his territory. And so these Bible translators are having the same conversation. Oh, could it mean that? Could it mean mountains, plains? Well, Yahweh gets so offended, or El Shaddai, his other name, gets so offended when he hears that this is what the Syrians are saying. He says, I'll show them. And he wipes them out in the plains. The other possible meaning for El Shaddai is the powerful one, the destroyer. And that's the point he makes the next day. It doesn't matter if it's in the mountains or in the plains. He's the powerful one, the destroyer, let everybody know. And that's the name he uses right at the beginning when he introduces himself to Abraham. Here's this verse that says, I am the Almighty, walk before me and be blameless. And you go to the root meanings and you realize what he's just said is, I'm the powerful one, the destroyer. Walk in front of me and don't put a foot wrong. And I think in that encounter, you've got the roots of all our ideas that God is somebody to be feared and tiptoed around and not offended and obeyed, you know, to the letter.
Well, it really struck me when you quoted Mauro in the book as saying something along the lines of there's no term in Hebrew that indicates the God that we understand as God. It just doesn't exist. It's not in there,
yeah.
Which totally changes, obviously, the meaning of so much of the Bible. You know, when we're no longer talking about a monotheistic almighty God, as you're underlying here, we're talking about a collection. We're talking about a plural of entities.
Well, if I can finesse what Mauro says, because he's very provocative in the way he expresses that, the idea of a transcendent being is there in the Hebrew scriptures at the end,
okay,
in some of the writers. But he's absolutely right. There's no word for it. They're using this Yahweh word. And as soon as you tell people the Old Testament has no word for a transcendent God, this is impossible, surely, because isn't that what the book's all about? And if it doesn't have a word for that, you then have to ask, well, what is it about then? Is it just, you know, memories of this, that, and the other contact, or was it written to teach us something quite different?
Well, I mean, what is the connection between the Bible and the ancient Mesopotamian tales? I mean, this is when you put this into context and you start to reveal the true translations of these words and how they've been changed over time, we start to see that there's a lot in common between the tales of the Sumerians and what we're reading about in the Bible. Is the Bible simply a re-edit of these ancient Mesopotamian tales?
Ben, you have asked the $64,000 question there.
Okay.
Because some might listen to what we've said so far and say, but this is circular reasoning. If you replace these words with ET or alien or
okay,
extraterrestrial colonizer, of course you've suddenly got an ET narrative, but that's actually not what we're doing. When you go to the root meanings of the words and reread the stories using the root meanings, the stories don't change in a random way. They change so as to parallel at every twist and turn the narratives from out of ancient Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria. And it was 150 years ago that we found the translation key to read those ancient narratives when we discovered the Behistun inscription in Iran. And then it was in the 1870s when George Smith used that key to translate the ancient Mesopotamian stories and instantly recognized the source narratives of the Bible. The stories of Genesis and really all through the Hebrew canon are summary forms of the longer, stranger stories to be found in the Sumerian canon. And the moments that overlap are all moments of trauma, really. So you've got a planetary reset. You've got genetic modification of our ancestors. You've got a genociding flood. You've got tampering with our DNA to shorten our lifespan. You've got conflicts over human population and human longevity. You've got the destruction of a spacefaring civilization, the Tower of Babel story from Genesis 11. You've got wars in space between factions of these powerful ones. And so very quickly, George Smith and those who followed him realized that the Elohim stories of the Bible, including the stories of El Elyon, El Shaddai, Yahweh, El Avekron, and all the others, were summary forms of the Mesopotamian stories of sky people.
Yeah.
And so the next question is, what's the significance of the fact that our familiar God stories are based on somebody else's stories of sky people. And our modern word for sky people is ET or astronaut.
This leads to this idea that the academic scholarly understanding of the Bible, I mean, you're talking about these discoveries being made a long time ago, has now essentially diverged from what the faithful believe. It's diverged from what is taught in the religion, in the spirituality. You know, what is the divide there? How great is that divide?
Yes, this is something that puts a lot of fire in my belly, because it annoys me that at an academic level, I can find plenty of people who will read my books and say, yes, I agree with 90% of what you're saying, or, you know, you're onto a real issue there. At an academic level, this is known. But in the rank and file of the churches, this is taboo. This is impossible. You know, as I said earlier, I get all these emails from people who say this is blasphemy and you're going to hell for saying things like this. You're luring people to hell with all this false doctrine, and they don't know what their own pastor learnt at theological college and knows privately, yeah, but right, hasn't quite found a way of working into a sermon. It's been a taboo for so long that perhaps 150 years is a short time to expect that information to filter into sermons. And many churches, if a preacher stands up and starts putting forward these ideas, he'll be out of a job very quickly. That'll be the end of his teaching relationship with that community of faith. So it's actually quite tricky to move the conversation forward.
But you're saying there is a certain amount of church leaders, of pastors, preachers who do understand this, that do understand maybe not all the conclusions that we're coming to, but at least that the translations have problems, that they are connected to these ancient stories, these ancient Sumerian stories, for example. They do know this.
They would certainly know there are problems, and many would know that what I'm saying is a perfectly reasonable possibility if we look at how to interpret those stories. There were very significant church fathers right at the beginning of Christianity saying all this openly, saying you can't take the Elohim and Yahweh stories as stories of God. They're stories about a completely different kind of entity.
Yeah, wow.
And some of them were quite specific, from off planet. And they were echoing the teaching of Plato when they said that. So anyone who does theology to a degree level understands where I'm coming from, even if they can't go 100% of the way. But it's a problem that in many churches, the congregations sort of police the doctrine of the pastor. And if he departs from the script, that becomes a problem for the pastor.
Of course.
He might very well lose his job. I was very fortunate. I could do this research and produce these books when in between pastorates, so to speak. That's what gave me the freedom to put it out there.
So let's back up and put this into perspective. We're talking about very powerful, possibly extraterrestrial beings who came to the earth in the ancient past and manipulated humanity. Perhaps there's an argument genetically modified our ancestors, essentially colonized our earth and us.
Well, they civilized us as well in giving us agriculture.
And yeah, there's positives to the story as well. And, you know, I'm giving a very brief summary, but our ancestors recorded this narrative, but then at some point in history, we've come along and said, no, this is all about one God. When did this happen? Who did this? What's the motivation for this? Why would you change what is essentially a warning of sorts to this distortion of the original meaning?
Well, what was there before wasn't just a warning, because there was a spectrum of contact experiences. So there was the violent colonization experience, but there was also that primordial tuition, that raising of our species to becoming a civilization. So there was a huge library of memory. And that's why Jeremiah, the prophet, could tell us, and it's there in 2 Kings as well, that the ancient Jews remembered Asherah, the female tutor, the Queen of Heaven, with affection, and that she was commemorated on every high hill and under every green tree and in every place where they lived. And then Jeremiah goes on to say, but the people despised Yahweh, and they rejected his laws, and they spoke slightingly of him. And they worshipped other powerful ones as well. So that was the before. And it wasn't just a grassroots remembrance, like I experienced in Brazil, for instance. The kings were building temples to commemorate these other advanced beings. King Solomon, the greatest of kings in the Hebrew tradition, built a whole temple for Asherah in Jerusalem and employed priests to service that temple. And when we read about the priests of Asherah or the priests of Baal, we forget they were Jewish priests. So you've got this whole spectrum going on. And then the 8th century BCE comes along and we have Hezekiah, who becomes king. And he is a different kind of Yahwist. He believes that Yahweh should be obeyed and everybody else should be forgotten. And he didn't want to tolerate these other practices related to the paleocontact stories. And so he sent the Jerusalem guard into the Jerusalem temple to destroy the carvings commemorating the Hebrew word is the Tseva Hashemayim, the sky armies. He wants to destroy the memory of this spectrum of entities that's there even in the Jerusalem temple. And he wants to disband the other priesthoods, demolish the other temples. His armies go around knocking down those standing stones marking the places of contact. So he's the beginning of the process. And Hilkiah, the high priest. Now, from the high priest's perspective, at the beginning of his career, he is looking at a Judea that is littered with temples. And this comes as a surprise to many Bible readers because they think there's only one temple in Jerusalem. Judea was littered with temples and priestly families acknowledging these beings. Hilkiah thinks we'd be much better off if all those tithes came to Jerusalem, to my temple, instead of all the other ones.
So it's a power play. It's a political power play.
So there's wealth being centralized, and then there's the control of the narrative. There should be only one high priestly family telling everybody what to believe. That should be me and my family. And so that was the agenda. Get rid of the other priesthoods. Get rid of the other stories, the other installations, other temples. We're going to have one temple, one high priest, one God, one king. So the attempt is to turn it into a theocratic society. And it was his grandson, Josiah, who really bedded that down. Or I should say his advisors bedded it down, because when Josiah became king, he was only 8 years old. And needless to say, he needed advisors. And Hilkiah stepped forward. Let me help you, sire. And so every time Hilkiah says, I've identified another threat, your majesty, to your authority over the kingdom, would you like me to take care of it? Well, of course, this boy would say, oh, yes, Uncle Hilkiah, thank you so much.
Yeah.
And what that meant every time was another bunch of priests gotten rid of, another temple demolished, and it's this centralization of power, one God, one king, one high priest, one temple, all the tithes coming centrally to that. And it was quite a strategic change, because if Jewish society was now a theocracy, based on a set of beliefs around one God and obedience to him, it made the high priesthood that much more powerful. And 23 years after the death of Josiah, there are no more Jewish kings. So there's only the high priestly authority. And hey, presto, Judaism has become a religion. It enables it to survive its period of exile and dominance where it had no kings of its own, but it's changed into a monotheistic religion, whereas before it was a group of people with a whole canon of memory of paleocontact. And
yes,
that change, we're told it in plain sight. We're told when Hilkiah sent the armies in. We're told about the decisions Josiah took. But somehow we miss it. Because we equate Yahweh with God, we see this as religious reform and we all applaud it and forget it's actually a suppression of ancient memory.
And of course, I mean, there would have been so much to destroy to form this narrative. They couldn't have got it all. And so this is how we have clues left behind And I find that Sky Army's translation so fascinating. Like, this is one of the examples. That word, what is it? Seba Hashemayim.
Seba Hashemayim.
Hashemayim.
Yes.
And I believe that's translated as the heavenly host, right?
Yes, that's sort of the traditional language for it. But the problem with the traditional language, heavenly host, we recognize that from Christmas carols, perhaps. And so we're picturing angels in the sky singing Christmas carols, or the Sistine Chapel ceiling with these beautiful people draped only in sheets. I don't think that's what the Tzeva Hashemayim meant. Sky armies suggest something a little bit more, well, militaristic, should we say. Maybe with, I mean, what are they doing in the sky? I mean, that implies technology right away. And the stories that follow, the destructive power of their technology, reinforces that we are looking at beings arriving in technology, which is described in some of the books of the Bible, to dominate and colonize the planet.
And of course, this paleo contact, you make it very clear that this would bring the ancient people, the ancient Hebrews, in line with many of the beliefs of other, you know, ancient people around the world. You mentioned the Australian Aboriginals and their belief in entities coming from the stars. There's the Cherokees. I believe they have a story of connected with the Pleiades as well. You mentioned the Dogon people in Sirius, the ancient Egyptians and Orion. So this is not just a ancient Hebrew thing.
No.
Getting back to those clues that reveal this connection, I wanted to quickly mention this discovery by the Frenchman Roland de Vaux at Tel El Farah, which you visited, of this 3-meter-tall standing stone depicting Asherah, depicting this queen of heaven. And there's some clues on this I found intriguing. What does this carving, this relief, display, and what are the clues that connect us to this idea of paleo contact?
Yes, so Tel El Farah was another community that did these festivals to remember Asherah, the Queen of Heaven. And he found this, it's called a naos. And a naos is a very interesting kind of object. Some are very large, some are quite small. The one at Tel El Farah is actually quite small. It's 30 centimeters tall. But what it represents is a doorway. So the doorway has these inverted palm trees, which is symbology for Asherah. And if I describe to you a doorway that has no building around it, it's a doorway to nowhere. There's nothing behind it. It's just a doorway. And yet through that doorway, advanced beings like Asherah can step into our world. Well, I'd suggest we have
a portal.
We have that word, the portal, exactly. That's what it is. The conventional explanation is that the building is to be considered implied.
Ah, okay.
And which is marvelous, isn't it? And it's therefore just like a badge saying, well, near here is a building where we celebrate Asherah. And this little legend above the doorway is a clue as to when the festival should happen. So that's the conventional understanding. That cluster of stars represents a time of year when we celebrate Asherah in a building that's implied near here. There's another possible meaning to the stars and the crescent moon above the doorway, because symbology is a language of many layers. And in the Eden Conspiracy, I give the example of my own experience. When I was working as a priest in London, and we were wearing all the robes and doing all these ceremonies, I was told they all had a Christian meaning, which they did. But somebody from Second Temple Judaism would come along and see our reserved sacrament, this bit of bread left over from the Eucharist, kept in a special cupboard in the corner. They'd say, oh, I see you do the showbread, just the same way we do in the Jerusalem temple. And I'd realize there's a Jewish meaning. Or he'd watch, or somebody from the Roman Empire would watch our processions and say, oh, I can understand all the statements about power and compliance you're making here. Or they'd see the bishop arrive in purple and say, oh, I can see he's in charge because he's wearing the royal purple chosen by King Cyrus of Persia. And then when he puts his hat on, an ancient Babylonian would say, oh, I can see he's the teacher. He's wearing that fish-shaped hat. And so, yes, there are Christian meanings invested in all these ceremonies, processions, objects, but there's a Babylonian meaning too, a Persian meaning, a Roman meaning, a Jewish meaning. And those predate the Christian meaning. So we've appropriated someone else's symbology. What if that's what has happened on this naos? What if we ask, what does a crescent moon and stars mean in the symbology of the source culture from ancient Sumeria? If we do that, it's not a calendar, it's a star map. The crescent moon represents the bull, the Taurus constellation.
Okay, right.
And those stars represent stars on the shoulder of the Taurus constellation. They're the stars of the Pleiades. Now, this isn't my theory. William Deaver argues for that.
And I presume there's seven stars, naturally. It's seven, right?
Seven stars, that's right. So here you've got this object that's really offering a story. This is how Asherah came to Tel El-Farah, through a portal. And this is where she came from. From a planet orbiting one of the stars of the Pleiades. Now, some people might say, well, that's a stretch, Paul, until you realize that cultures all around the world, and Ben, you mentioned one, the Cherokee people, but it's there in Australian story, Chinese story. Many of these ancient cultures say the Pleiades is where our ancient tutors came from to enable us to make that great leap forward. And in that naos at Tel El-Farah, I would suggest that the ancient Hebrew people were saying exactly the same thing.
Did you watch the coronation, Paul?
No, I didn't. My cat's been badly injured this week, so I had other priorities.
Sorry to hear that.
I'm sorry to say. I will catch up with it on YouTube, but you're probably asking me about this because of what Charles was sitting
on. No, I wanted to know about, Queen, the princess something's dress. I don't even know. It was on in my house, but I wasn't really watching it. Of course, I'm asking about the Stone of Destiny. You trace its origins back to what we're talking about today. I'd love you to break this down because I didn't realize it went so far back to these ancient stories.
Yes, yeah, so many people know just the most recent history of the Stone of Destiny, which is 336 pounds of sandstone built into the throne that Charles is crowned on. And what is it doing there? Why is it important? Well, it was important enough to the English kings that they stole it from Scotland in 1296 and have used it for the coronation of English kings from that time to this. The idea is that it gives Charles and his predecessors and heirs and successors the right to govern Scotland.
Yeah, well, Australia as well in some sense.
They've got Australia. I mean, goodness me, they've got Australia. When I bought my house here, Australians like to think they own the properties they buy, but my conveyancer was doing her job when she said, you do know there's a prior claim on your property and it's that of the Windsor family.
Yeah. It's leased from the Windsors, right?
What?
So you can only ever have this on lease from the Windsor family because they own everything in Australia.
This is why we need guns to keep the King of England out of your face.
Good argument, Aaron.
Don't get beheaded, Aaron. But let's go back to Scotland. So this 336 pounds of stone is Scottish authority, the right to rule over Scotland, because previously it was used as the coronation seat for Scottish kings. Prior to that, Irish kings, and the Irish had got it from Spain, and that had been sourced from Egypt and Syria, and the story goes all the way back, and this stone, so the story goes, began its life as part of the Ark of the Covenant, and a very specific part of the Ark of the Covenant, part of the standing stones that Jacob erected at Bethel to mark the place where he experienced first contact with beings who came from space, landed on the planet's surface, and then departed back up into space via something he called a ladder. Now, if it's going into space, I'd suggest it's not a literal ladder. This is his metaphor for some technology enabling this transport. But the point is, this was a story of ET contact. And this was Jacob's right to rule. This was his authority, that he's got these standing stones that say he met these beings. And so it then becomes part of the Ark of the Covenant, which is the vested object of the Israelite story. The rulers of Israel, they have this stone, gives them the right to govern. And then it travels around the world, and now Charles has it. giving him the right to govern. Now, even if that story is not all historically accurate, the fact that that is the belief about the stone, that that's why it's so important to King Charles, that he has it under his chair when he's crowned, why is his authority rooted in a story to do with ET contact? The idea that the right to govern comes from the stars, comes from beings who came from the stars, and then this object is commemorated and sort of housed, represented that power from that time to this. And this happens in other cultures as well, where the right to rule of the kings and queens is inherited from the star people or the sky people who governed before.
This is fascinating to put in the context of colonization, because you have the idea that these original ruling entities eventually were succeeded by human beings. We took over these roles. But when you look at the Ark of the Covenant as an example, it's almost like these gods, these entities, were still in the ears of the human rulers, because the Ark of the Covenant, of course, had that ability to commune with God, right? I mean, it would allow you to communicate with the entity.
That's correct. So when the leader is seated adjacent to the Ark of the Covenant, that's when he'll get communication from Yahweh. And the idea is a little bit like the Pope being in cathedra, that when he's sat there, you have to believe what he says absolutely and do what he tells you absolutely, because he's getting instructions from afar. So it's a remote communication device. And that idea of the kings and queens having remote communication with the former powers, I mean, bear in mind, you've got the leaders of Israel who are communing with this entity with fire-breathing snout, flight feathers.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same when you get into Mesoamerica and Queen Shuk is trying to get instructions from the feathered serpents using their vested objects, which look like Bluetooths.
Yeah.
So that then what she says will be believed absolutely and what she orders will be done absolutely, because she's got this instruction from afar from the feathered serpent. It's the exact same idea.
Yeah, you mentioned the carvings in this Mayan city. What's it? Yaxchilan.
Yaxchilan.
Yes. Carvings that look like technology, carvings that look like flying devices, these weird microphones they seem to have on their faces. The question is, were these, I guess the implication is it's some kind of advanced technology that these beings left behind. But is there a certain point where they become, it's almost like a cargo cult, where we can't replicate what was left and it just becomes a religion of sorts? It becomes ceremony.
I think that's a really good analogy. To our eye, we look at the carvings in Yaxchilan and we see things that look like Bluetooths, breathing apparatus, space helmets, and you might ask the local guide, why is Queen Shuk wearing something that looks like a Bluetooth? And he'll say, oh, that carving is just representing what the kings and queens and priests wore to designate their advancement and intelligence. But that's only half an answer. Why did they carve something that looked like a Bluetooth to represent advancement? And I think your analogy is right. I think that when we look at the carvings, we are seeing headgear that the Jaguar dynasty had made, but they were copying technology that they had seen. So what looks like a Bluetooth, I think, is probably not. It's something they had made that looks like technology they saw the previous rulers using. And the clue to that is that Queen Shuk may be wearing a microphone, a Bluetooth, but in order to achieve remote communication, which is clearly what she's trying to do. The other details of the carving show you this is what's being attempted, remote communication in the place of the voices.
Yeah.
But the clue that that's not a working Bluetooth is she's actually doing a bloodletting ceremony at the same time through pulling a knotted rope through her tongue in order to induce a near-death experience because at that point, that's when she'll start hearing the voices, which is perhaps not too surprising. But the idea
doesn't work.
The technology doesn't work, so they have to do these shamanic protocols in order to broker contact experiences. And for me, that is a big clue of lots of things. Clue about contact, and it's a clue that the technology was copied, but they didn't know how to make the real thing. And the same thing is in the Bible. Urim and Thummim, exactly the same story.
Well, I loved this idea. This is a fantastic part of your book where you describe Moses as being a contactee of sorts, with the description of this, him meeting with Yahweh and this cloudy pillar being described. You believe this was something akin to modern high technology. What made you think that Moses was actually contacting some kind of technological being?
Well, what is described for us with a degree of fascination by the eyewitnesses and then the narrator is this pillar that is accompanied by a cloud and fire. So sometimes, in hymns and Bibles, we might hear the pillar of cloud or the cloudy, fiery pillar, and we might picture a cloud. But again, read it closely, root meanings. It is a column or a pillar with a cloud and with fire that shakes the ground when it lands and shakes the ground when it launches.
That's right.
So you and I can picture that. So we're now picturing SpaceX. We're picturing a column that can launch vertically and land vertically. And that's what's described. And it has to launch and land way outside the camp, we're told. So you've got to have that blast protection, which is mentioned in Moses' encounter, because when at the end of this conversation with the pilot, Moses says, "Can I have a look at your," and we're used to hearing the word glory, but it means your big, heavy thing, this pillar. He said, "Well, yes, but you can't be out in the open when it launches or it'll kill you." And when we picture it as something creating a blast and shaking the ground, as is described, it makes perfect sense. He can't be out in the open. You must be in a cleft in the rock and I'll shelter you. And then you can see it moving away. So we can picture that. We get the idea. And the words used for it are kavod and tub and ruach. And if we want more detail on what it looks like, we get it in the book of Ezekiel, where we've got an eyewitness account, not only from the outside, but from the inside. And Ezekiel tells us the textures, the metallic textures, the transparent textures, the sound of the engine when it moves, the fact that there's a capsule that moves using rotors that respond to voice commands. We get a huge amount of detail from Ezekiel. He points out that it's piloted by a hachyach, a life form, that when it speaks to him, it addresses him as earthling, a little clue that this is a close encounter going on. And then there's another bit of technology mentioned in that story, because apparently this life form is talking to Ezekiel about Yahweh's great displeasure, about these carvings in the Jerusalem temple of these other entities. And he says that families who are not grieved, that those are still remembered, will be killed. It sounds ridiculous until you realize there are cultures on the planet today that if your family doesn't show open grief at the sickness or death of the leader, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, great point.
And that was what was expected at this point, that these families would come out and grieve, and if they wouldn't, they could be killed. And six individuals are dispatched by the life form with devices called a Keli Mashatal, or a Keli Mapasau. One is a destroying thing, one is a disintegrating thing. And apparently six individuals, armed with one of those, can ethnically cleanse an entire district. So I find it very difficult to read that in a non-technological way. We're told the sight, the sound, the feeling, and the results.
Well, especially if you include the story of the NASA engineer, what was his name? Joseph Blumrich. He wanted to debunk von Daniken, didn't he? Von Daniken has always described the Ezekiel passages as an encounter with a craft, an extraterrestrial craft. And Joseph wanted to debunk this, but I can't remember all the details of that story, but didn't he go on to completely agree with von Daniken? Like, he thought this was clearly describing a machine.
You're absolutely right. I mean, initially, he couldn't take Erich von Daniken's claim seriously that there is technology in the Bible. Erich had been invited to speak to the Advanced Propulsions Unit at the Marshall Space Center by NASA. He gave that talk, and then Blumreich goes up afterwards over coffee and says, I think you're reading the Bible in the wrong way. It's a spiritual book. You won't find any technology in it. And Erich von Daniken says, have you read Ezekiel? Have you read it lately? And challenges him to do it. So Blumreich goes away and reads it with an engineer's eye. And not only does he completely change his mind and realize this is technology, he goes further and realizes this is ET technology. He points out that this is an ET entity being described. And then, just to make it really real, he goes and slaps a patent on the omnidirectional wheels that Ezekiel described.
That's right.
Not only did he get a patent for the omnidirectional wheel, but NASA has used it on remote rovers from that day to this. It is an actual real piece of technology. And I wish I could remember that patent number off by heart, but it's a real patent and it's a real device currently used because Ezekiel described it so accurately.
Incredible.
So when people want to say this is a spiritual encounter, there's a patent on it, for goodness sake. You can't patent the Spirit of God, which is the conventional translation.
I really enjoyed this part of your research where you break down the passages, you describe exactly what you think is really being described. It's just, it's riveting going through these parts and getting a real kind of reveal of what's being described in these ancient stories. Fantastic work. Like, we've got to commend you again, just another dynamite addition to your series of books. But I think perhaps one of the final questions I have for you is, you mentioned this is like these stories are spiritual stories today. That's how they're understood. But where does this leave the spirituality of Christianity? Where does this leave the religion? If the Bible is in some parts, in perhaps even most parts, this description of this paleo contact, what room do we have for the teachings of Jesus, for example? Is it in conflict with what's been uncovered by this research? What's the state of Christianity in relation to these new understandings of the book of the Bible?
Well, it reframes how we understand Jesus. So once we clean up our idea of what God might be referring to, and we realize it's not referring to an angry, mercurial being who will burn you to nothing if you offend him, you then realize that Jesus' teachings aren't framed by that belief. It isn't all about escaping hell and going to heaven. This is a construct. And if you start looking at the root meanings of what Jesus was on about, you begin to see some things joining up. I argue in the Eden Conspiracy that Jesus actively distances himself from the Yahweh and Elohim stories, that is not what he's talking about when he uses the word Father or the word God. And that when he uses Father, he says, I'm talking about something you've not yet experienced. I'm talking about a heavenly Father, a cosmic Father. His first sermon, this is a root meanings argument, his first sermon that he toured with for a year, according to the Gospel of Matthew, the way it's translated at the moment sounds like a threat. It sounds like, I mean, he says, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And it sounds like he's saying, you'd better clean your life up because God is about to show up and you wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him. And we hear it that way because of all the framing of these angry, violent stories from the Hebrew scriptures. Root meanings tell us something else. Repent, the word is metanoiete. Go beyond the mind. Go beyond the mind because the realm of the cosmos is available to you. The powers, the principles, the people of the cosmos are available to you. So go beyond the mind. That's his message for a whole year. And after you've reframed the Hebrew scriptures, you realize Jesus is onto something far more cosmic and exploratory. And he makes statements like this all through the Gospels that are an invitation for us to explore what is possible for human beings. And as I pointed out in previous Eden books, the narratives that our ancestors curated that preserve the memory of paleo contact all speak of us having higher cognitive abilities that we can recover, that we were actually dumbed down in the genetic process that led to Homo sapiens sapiens, that we had another sapiens on our name in the beginning, and that things were put into the environment to dumb us down. But all these cultures had shamanic and mystical protocols to help us switch them back on. So there's a reframing of Jesus. There's a re-understanding of what God means, realize that something far more cosmic is being described, and an invitation to explore all the wonderful potentialities that flow from that, along with the message that emerges when you read the Hebrew scriptures through the lens of paleo contact. And the stories become about cosmic help and the power that comes when we discover one another and learn to behave collectively and collaboratively, and the insight we should have into covert government and hidden hands in politics and economics. The agenda of those books is to equip us all in all to have a better human experience. And that's what it's really about.
What responsibility do the churches have to not necessarily spread the same kind of message, reveal the same kind of research you're revealing, but frame the original texts in a more accurate way? Do you think, what's their path forward, you know, if they understand this information?
Well, I think the Roman Catholic Church put a good foot forward in 2009 when it held its colloquium. So this is the most conservative pope of my lifetime, Benedict XVI, calls on the Pontifical Academy of Sciences to discuss the theological implications of a populated universe, the theological implications of contact. I think if they can do that and show believers that there is a serious conversation to be had here, that something that we can explore, if they can do that, then why can't the leaders of all the other churches do exactly the same thing? And I hope that my books are a provocation to the churches to get that kind of conversation rolling, because until they do that, people are laboring under a misapprehension. They are tiptoeing around this violent entity who's just waiting to nuke them if they do the wrong thing. I think that's terribly damaging psychologically. And we do far better thinking and far better living when we're not in craven fear. And for that reason as well, I think we need to have this conversation publicly.
Please don't stop what you're doing, because we're loving all of it. The new book is fantastic. The Eden Conspiracy, Ancient Memories of ET Contact, and The Bible Before God. Highly recommended. Really enjoyed it. And of course, we have to point people towards your website, paulanthonywallace.com. And don't forget the YouTube channel, The Fifth Kind. It's at The Fifth Kind on YouTube. We'll link to that in the show notes as well.
And we also have a website, fifthkind.tv as well.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm going to add that as well, fifthkind.tv. Paul, thanks again for your time. Always a pleasure to have you. And we wish you the best with the new release.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Huge thanks again to Paul for appearing on the show. The book, The Eden Conspiracy, is available now. We'll link to it in our show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org. You can also find Paul at paulanthonywallace.com. And he's got this great new website, Fifth Kind TV, fifthkind.tv, that has all his videos. And we'll link to his incredibly popular YouTube channel as well, which is also The Fifth Kind. Yeah, pleasure to have him back on the show. And it just makes you think about what we understand of our history when things start to get reframed, when the original meanings of these words start to be unveiled. You kind of have to start rethinking everything, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's an element, I suppose, of interpretation that comes in here. But Paul, you know, the way that he writes, it just makes you, it doesn't lead you, but it certainly causes you to go in a certain direction that makes you go, I think there's something to this.
Yeah, and it doesn't take away from the moral teachings of Christianity.
Of course not, no.
And he does a good job of explaining how the teachings of Jesus aren't necessarily changed in a major way in terms of the moral underpinning of them, but just the context of our history starts to shift.
Well, my interpretation is, though, it's more like these beings, there's two groups. It's like there was a good group that came that instilled these, well, first of all, agriculture, and also, you know, gave us principles and ideas. But then there's another group that seems to be, I don't know, just not having the best intentions for humanity.
Yeah, but when you're running a colony, you kind of want your subjects to have agriculture and to have all those things to produce, because they have to produce for you. That's the point of your colony. So yeah, make sure you pick up the book. There's a ton more in there than what we covered. And again, we'll link to it at mysteriousuniverse.org. But Aaron, tell us, what's coming up in Plus?
Well, I've got an update to that anecdote I was telling you recently about a family member of mine that was having dreams or suffering from hypnic migraines. And he had a dream that essentially seemingly has led him to a cure. And so I'm going to go into the details of that, but it inspired me.
He dreamt about a mountain herb, basically.
That's right. He dreamt about an invasive cactus species, which isn't supposed to be there, and he had no knowledge of, and yet somehow this information came to him. So I'm going to be looking into some of these other experiences of dreams, you know, assisting people in their life, giving them direction. But then I'm going to go a little bit further and look at where dreams and interactions with beings and entities start to collide with other elements of the paranormal, including things like premonitions, but then also alien encounters, you know, some type of ghostly encounters. And then we're going to get into the parasites and the really dark
parasites.
Yeah, and the pets, the Hat Man's pets, these parasitic.
Are they the
horrible
ones that have the parasites?
No, they're horrible.
He has to get
they are parasites.
For the worms.
And you can pick them up in people's homes. It's like this strange thing that you can get into certain people's homes. So that will all be revealed in the Plus extension coming up just after this.
Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus for all the details. Sign up today. You get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday. And of course, Plus members get an entirely exclusive show every single Tuesday as well. You're getting more than double the content if you sign up for Plus. Plus members also get a higher quality audio version of the show, a totally ad-free version of the show. And if you upgrade to MU Max, you get access to our massive back catalogue. It's all in there, ready to go for you. MysteriousUniverse.org/plus. Help support your favourite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Extension, great to have you with us.